Hey, Immigrantee family, this is Sadia Khan. It seems like spring is finally in the air. The temperatures are rising in a good way. And believe it or not, it's in the 70s in New York today. My sweaters are packed and set aside, and I'm already browsing online for some cute spring summer attire. Although I keep thinking, do I need more clothes? And that reminds me. I was talking to my guest, Ramzi Fawaz, a couple of weeks ago, and we started talking about the problem of abundance. How throughout human history, we're not supposed to have so much abundance of everything. Fruits are no longer seasonal. You can get peaches and strawberries even in fall and winter, which to me is bizarre. Amazon delivers within a day. We can shop on Instagram with a click of a button. So what does it do to our psyche? Well, I believe it makes us egotistic, less empathetic, less patient for sure, and it takes away the expression of gratitude. And hence my struggle with whether or not I should order more clothes. So what do we do? I, for one, am thinking of honoring the seasonality of food at least. Not buying stuff if it's not meant to be around naturally. Maybe limit shopping to one round a month or a season and wake up humming gratitude, something we often forget. And now to today's guest. She has written a book about humanitarianism, but not the kind that makes you feel warm and fuzzy inside. This is the kind that asks you to sit with discomfort, to really ask when Muslim organizations fly across the world to do good, whose definition of good are they operating with? What happens when the very act of helping is shaped by the same racial capitalism and white supremacy it claims to push back against? Professor Rhea Rahman is an assistant professor of anthropology at Brooklyn College, CUNY. She spent over a decade in the field in the UK, South Africa, Mali, studying Islamic Relief, the largest Islamic NGO based in the West. And out of all that research, she's written Racializing the Ummah, Muslim Humanitarians Beyond Black, Brown, and White. This book challenges everything you may think you know about charity, Muslim identity, and the meaning of doing good. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Welcome, Rhea. I am so glad to have you on my show. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, absolutely.
How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm really excited to be here. I'm new to doing podcast interviews, so I'm really excited.
Oh my gosh, is this your first podcast interview?
This is technically my second, so.
And you're traveling today.
I am traveling today. I'm very excited about the travels too. I have some book events in Detroit where I grew up and where my parents live. So I'll be going home, spending time with them, and then doing some events there. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, that's so nice. It's so good to have family back, right? I have two girls, and every time they come back from college or work or whatever, it makes me so happy. Days prior, there is so much anticipation. I'm sure your parents are looking forward to it more than you could ever imagine. So So you grew up in Detroit, you said. What was childhood like there?
I grew up outside of Detroit in the suburbs. And I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm doing an event at a bookstore in Detroit. And I'm speaking with, it'll be a panel discussion about the book. And I was thinking through what kind of conversation I want to have for the event. And I was thinking, you know, the ideas for this book were shaped by my experiences growing up in what I feel is a really like racially segregated suburb. You know, in the book, I talk about how Muslims as a group are racialized, but then within Muslims, how racial categories are kind of remade and reinforced. And for me, that was so much about growing up as a brown Muslim and so close to Detroit, but so separated from a Black Muslim community in Detroit. And so much of what I'm exploring in the book is these different ways of being Muslim and how race has such a kind of overarching conditioning of how we form our ideas. So for me, growing up in Michigan, the model minority, my parents came from Bangladesh. They first came south. So my brother and I, we were both born in Alabama, and my dad's an engineer. That first generation that really came after 65, so many went south because they had a connection or the universities were easier to get into than other places. So I don't remember much of Alabama, but my parents think about it so fondly, which again, like thinking of the kind of model, what it was like for them as Bangladeshi immigrants in Alabama in the 70s. But my growing up in Michigan, it took so many years to learn the impact of what being one of the only people of color in my school. Like there was a strong Bangladeshi community. Every weekend there'd be the dawat, like dawats, we'd go to parties. And so there was a community that I grew up with, but at my school, it was almost all white. And I think I responded to that in wanting to be white. I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to have different kinds of foods. I didn't want to be different. And that, I think, shaped so much of me that it was only in college that I had South Asian friends who were actually proud of being South Asian. They were part of the Indian Student Association and they wanted to do Bollywood dances. And for me growing up, I was ashamed. I didn't watch Bollywood. I wanted to make fun of it, or I didn't listen to any of the music. And so my response, I think, to the way I grew up was to try and move away from anything that made me different, that made me not white. I wanted to be white growing up. And so the book in so many ways is like a reckoning with what that foundational shaping did.
You know, that's exactly what I was going to ask you next. Is this book a catharsis of sorts, or reclaiming that identity? And also in the process, highlighting or amplifying the racialization of the Muslim Ummah, because your book really delves deep into the aspect of racialization. We talk a lot about racial hierarchies within the US, but then we don't often talk about racial hierarchies that exist within different communities, and not just Muslim communities, like South Asian communities, other communities. So I do want to pivot to your book and your research, because you spent over a decade working with Islamic Relief, which is one of the largest Muslim charity organizations in the West. And that kind of time spent, Rhea, is not just research, right? It's relationship building. So I'm curious to know, what drew you in other than reckoning with your own identity? And what kept you there despite seeing some very problematic and complicated patterns emerge?
You know, I think I say a lot, my research is driven by this question of what does it mean to do good? And as a child of immigrants, I wanted to do good. Growing up, my mom would pack tons of gifts and clothing and toys to take to my family in Bangladesh. And when I was six, I didn't understand. I was like, why don't I get presents from my family there? And, you know, like no idea about inequality and political economy. And by the time I finished college, I had a better understanding, and I thought the answer was development. I want to go help Bangladesh develop, as if it's a problem that they just didn't know how. And I went as an intern, and that experience really shaped me in profound ways, that having this common experience of the dual identity, that I was not white enough in school, but then when I went to Bangladesh, I had more in common with all the other Canadian and American interns than I did with my fellow Bangladeshi colleagues there. So being, you know, out of place in both places, but something about the development, it felt like it wasn't getting at the root of the problem. There was an experience I had. There was a big event. UNICEF was celebrating a publication they had, and they were focusing on the year of the girl, and they were really focused on girls' education. And so it was in this national press hall in central Dhaka, this fancy building, and they had bussed in all of these girls from orphanages around Dhaka. And at some point I asked, well, where's it? I needed to go to the restroom. And they said, oh, there's no women's facility in this building. And it was those types of contradictions. I'm like, you've bussed in all of these girls for this event, but there's no women's facility, you know, much less even gender nonconforming. But after that experience, I felt I want to understand the root of the problem better in an effort or hope of contributing to a different kind of answer. So that's what drew me to Islamic Relief, of what does aid look like when it's shaped in name by Islamic ethics? And that's then where these questions about how Muslims are racialized. So Islamic Relief is targeted and surveilled, and in ways that their non-Muslim counterparts are not. The number of times that they've had to do audits or audit themselves, and their financial records are crystal clear and completely transparent. That's one level. And then I get at the racialization amongst Muslims in terms of where do they work? Who do they prioritize? Where can they get funds from the Muslim community? Where can they then focus on doing aid work based on where they can get funding from? So, you know, it was over 10 years. It wasn't consistent because I was a graduate student and I was teaching and I was, you know, but I was able to go back to certain places repeatedly. But really it was the research and the question, because so much of this analysis was also shaped through not just my experience with Islamic Relief, but my own process and journey as a person. And, you know, for me, I came back, the largest chunk of my research I did in South Africa from 2012 to 2013. And when I came back a few years around that time was the rise of Black Lives Matter. And that movement shaped me so much. And it forced the conversation that the movement was really putting forward about racism as structural and tied to capitalism and legacies of colonialism. That pushed my research into a completely different direction. You know, the research was fascinating, and the growing and learning I was doing alongside kind of kept me in it throughout all of that.
So when you look back at the person you were going into this research and the person you've become now through your own experiences and your experience with BLM, how do you see yourself differently?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I see myself in process all the time, or I think of most things as process. And I feel grateful to, you know, I don't think of myself as individual or kind of separated. I understand myself as a part of a network. And it's, you know, the people in Islamic Relief that shared with me and helped me shape ideas. And it's my community, my friends, my family, chosen and bio, that have encouraged me to think differently. And so I think so much of the analysis is a product of all of these types of relationships. So, you know, I Malcolm X is present in the book so much, and ways that myself and so many people admire of him is that he was always growing and learning and changing as he grew and learned. And so, you know, this book is a product of where I am now, and I'm still growing and in process. And so the things I'll think about will be, you know, shaped by the ideas and people I'm interacting with now.
Rhea, a lot of times people who grow up in the U.S., or even immigrants like myself who've lived here for more than two decades, we start to occupy a position close to whiteness, right? Or white supremacy in some ways. Sometimes subconsciously, sometimes consciously. It's a choice, or sometimes we do it by default so that we can be acceptable. You've talked about this. And you mentioned when you went to Bangladesh, the idea was to help solve problems. You saw yourself as a problem solver. I would call that savior mentality that a lot of us imbibe, right, when we are living in the West. Somehow it just sticks in ways that we are unable to even fathom. Do you still see yourself as a problem solver?
That's such a great question. And exactly that, I think. The process of unlearning the whiteness. In other places, I talk about white adjacency. And there's a possibility for white adjacency, I think more so amongst non-Black people in the U.S. or immigrants, right, in ways that because of the kind of racial logics in the U.S. isn't as available to people racialized as Black. And so I'm in a process of unlearning, because exactly like you said, this is what's offered to immigrants. I teach at Brooklyn College, and you know, I would say it's almost all immigrants, even immigrants racialized as Black. There's such a large, you know, Black Caribbean and Black African community at Brooklyn College. And I notice similar things that students will say, you know, Black Caribbean or Black African students will say, yeah, my parents told me not to hang out with Black Americans, or to, you know, there's that part of the immigrant story that's sold is like, align yourself as much as possible. And these aren't necessarily conscious. Exactly. It's safety. It's, you know, I think of the things my mom encouraged me, like to straighten my hair or to not wear too bright of lipstick, you know, just things that were also about a mother's care of like, what will be best for my daughter? What kind of opportunities will she have or not have based on all of these things? So I like to think I've dismantled enough of that to not think I'm trying to save anyone. And, you know, I think where I end with the book is, you know, that I do think that savior mentality is aligned with whiteness. And what I've learned, what I talk about is what I call an Islamic Black radical tradition, is this mutuality that it isn't about, we're not individual, we're connected to all living beings, all ecologies, like we're not separate from. It's a legacy, I think, of colonialism and whiteness to teach us to separate, that we are separate from other people or from the land or from, you know, all living beings. So I definitely don't think I'm trying to save anymore, but trying to learn better and learn how our goals, our struggles are shared. It's not about me helping someone, but to understand, I'm trying to remember this quote, like, if you're here to help me, don't bother. But if you know that, you know, your oppression is tied up in mine, then we can work together.
Rhea, talk to me about the organization. I want to circle back to Islamic Relief. Now, you mentioned they obviously face scrutiny way more than other charitable organizations or nonprofits, because the organization was founded by British South Asians, again, with this lens or approximation to whiteness, but still a Muslim organization. And my understanding of Islamic Relief and the way they operate is they had to, by default, secularize themselves or present this idea of good Muslim aid workers, which to me is a very problematic trope, right? All of us, whether immigrants, kids of immigrants, especially Muslims, we've lived through it. This dichotomy between good Muslim and bad Muslim. Surveillance is acceptable. You are okay with projects like countering violent extremism, which is so problematic. I am embarrassed to say, when I was working at a civil society organization, I was part of the CVE movement, and I thought I was being the good Muslim and trying to really look at the root of extremism within Islam and maybe do some kind of reformation, my savior journey, right? What does that good Muslim aid worker figure look like? What do they do? And what do they crucially not do?
How I frame it is the good Muslim lacks political agency, right? That as long as, depending on what country that they're operating in, you know, they're bound by the legal and kind of governmental institutions and regulations in which they're working. And so to the extent, you know, I talk somewhere in the book in the UK, you know, where I'm framing the Prevent movement in the UK, and that's happening at the same time Islamic Relief is becoming a expert on Islamic humanitarianism. They're beginning to write policy documents on, you know, an Islamic interpretation of poverty reduction or Islamic interpretations of gender justice. And the reason they were able to do that was they got a big grant from the British government to formulate these policies, and which, you know, they use when they go to kind of multi-faith development conferences. They have the different religious groups and they want the Muslim voice at the table. Like, well, what do Muslims say about XYZ? And I'm saying we can't look at that intellectual kind of knowledge production outside of the context of the British government's interest in civilizing Muslims. And, you know, the language of the Prevent policy document, you know, there's excerpts. At the same time, it says we're not targeting, you know, this isn't about Islam versus the West, but it's about targeting madrasas and targeting Islamic institutions. And one of the documents commends this Bradford Mosque project that they've created materials that show that Islamic values are completely aligned with British values. But they never define what British values are or what Islamic values are or why those are assumed to be inherently antithetical to each other. So that pointing out that Islamic Relief has to secularize themselves in terms of a limit of what doing good can look like. After 9/11 in the UK, the Tony Blair government had created kind of a Muslim Council of Britain, and they had great relations. And when the UK was gathering support to go to war in Afghanistan, they wanted the Muslim Council of Britain to support that. The council was kind of caught in between, but the Muslim community in Britain said, no, absolutely not. And eventually the Muslim council said no, and then ultimately that soured the relationship between the government and that institution. So I try to frame people's choices as not, you know, like you were saying earlier with the whiteness or your own, you know, working at this civil institution, that this is what we learn. It's not a, you know, conscious, it's not out of a intention. It's more trying to understand what are the conditions within which we're making choices. And I would have done that too. And my life experiences had led me into a different place that forced me to reevaluate what I thought was good. And now it is aligned with what others might see as more radical or kind of, you know, questioning tenets of liberalism or working within or reformism, that I now see those as, okay, that's actually upholding the structure as it is. And how do we have to imagine otherwise to actually, you know, get at the root of the problem and create new structures and institutions?
Absolutely. And I feel like Muslims post 9/11 have had this reckoning in a bad way where they've questioned their religion. A lot of Muslims have had that internal dialogue within themselves, right? Where they felt like maybe they're doing something wrong or maybe their religion is actually problematic for the rest of the world. And when I say rest of the world, I'm basically talking about the West. There's been a lot of gaslighting around Islam and Islamic practices and how Muslims conduct themselves. I think even now, there are instances where a lot of Muslims try to secularize themselves because they feel like Islam is backward or it's outdated and it is not aligned with Western or modern values. How do you debunk that based on your research and your own reckoning with your identity?
All of that, exactly. That I think Islamic Relief is parts of it, right? Because I also talk about Islamic Relief as It's a very complicated structure. There's a global family. A lot of the partners are legally independent, you know, and that's changed throughout all of its time. And then they have the fundraising partners largely in the global north, and then the field offices that are largely in the global south. So, you know, to talk about Islamic Relief is also, it's not a singular kind of entity. And so the good Muslim part, I look at that at an institutional level at the headquarters. And I'm not sure if it still exists, but at the time I visited, there was the Policy and Research Institute. And those were the folks who are writing these documents. And I think that that chapter where I'm talking to the people who are working on that document, I think that is an effort to kind of modernize Islam, to, you know, there was so much discussion again amongst a particular kind of level at the organization of we have to professionalize. We can't be another kind of, we don't want to be like those backward Muslim charities, right? We want to be professional. We want to be respected like Oxfam or MSF. And so I think that realm of trying to prove oneself is, again, we do have to look at the context of Islamophobia that has othered Islam and, you know, assumed, makes the assumption Islam is antithetical to democracy, is antithetical to secularism, is antithetical to women's rights. And so that policy work is very much kind of, no, we are modern. And what I try to emphasize in the book is that there are other ways people have and do interpret Islam that's not from this apologetic, but that it is and has been a religion dedicated to justice in ways that, you know, that's distinct from the other monotheistic traditions. And, you know, given the history of how Islam begins, that there's a different kind of ethical orientation and mode that, that has been throughout that I think I'm also excited about. I saw it in Islamic Relief, but I also see it now amongst young Muslims transnationally in the UK, in the US, like abolitionist Muslims that are saying, this is our tradition. I don't write about them, but Believers Bailout, this group kind of based in Chicago that uses zakat to raise funds for bail bonds, and recognizing that one of the categories for zakat are captives, to recognize the injustice of the prison industrial system, this kind of radical interpretation that's not apologetic, that, you know, doesn't look at Islam as it's a problematic religion or we've done anything wrong, that looks at this is a religion dedicated to justice, and we can be proud of this faith tradition and look back because we have models. And that's what also I'm trying to do with the Islamic Black Radical tradition, that there are and have been kind of leaders and figures that have, you know, fought for justice in these profound ways in the name of Islam.
Talk to me about Black Muslim community within the bigger Muslim ecosystem and how they are radicalizing or maybe reconnecting with the idea of what Muslimness actually means.
You know, like I said, growing up just outside of Detroit, you know, I didn't know until my late adulthood that the Nation of Islam has origins in Detroit. And, you know, the role of these Eastern cities, Black religious movements, like including the Moorish Temple and Nation of Islam, were these religious movements that were also tied to a vision of Black nationalism that's responding to the racism experienced by Black communities. And that that kind of radical tradition, I see it as also shaping ways that the communities that I came into contact with, because I think it was largely Black Muslims working in Islamic Relief that were the first to bring into question what doing good meant.
How so?
I'm thinking of a Black Muslim community member or fundraiser with Islamic Relief. And in really early on in my research, you know, he'd said, we're the largest, you know, American Muslim organization, and what are we doing in our own communities? In Detroit or in DC, there's large Black Muslim communities that are disadvantaged, and what are we giving back to those communities? And I think there's also a recognition of, the Muslims who are donating to Islamic Relief, and I talk about that in on an international level of where donors want to give, the experience of racism in the U.S. doesn't get high on the list in terms of for Muslim donors of, oh, I should donate there. I should donate to, you know, support the community that's right around the corner. Like in the community I grew up in, I couldn't really imagine those folks donating to help Black people in Detroit. That racialized subject position and being in those communities, right, raised different questions of what we should be doing. But I also found that in South Africa amongst Black Muslims, that people were working at the organization, they understood the institutional constraints were not the things that they needed to do to respond to their community. You know, as one example, someone I spoke to who was working with a Muslim kind of HIV-related organization, and they were advocating abstinence and saying, like, don't promote condoms. And this person said, I can't go into the townships and talk about abstinence. Like, that's not going to work, and that's not realistic. You know, his mode was, how do we actually respond to people? And so those were some of what I saw in Islamic Relief as, you know, how to actually humanize and kind of respond to people despite these kind of institutional constraints.
Ria, what is the difference between Muslim advocacy in the UK versus the US? And I'm particularly interested in what's going on in the UK. We see this narrative, anti-Muslim, bigoted narrative around, you know, radical Muslim gangs that are killing people and that are hurting communities. Politically speaking, what is your understanding and how do you see this new narrative play out?
You know, one, I can't say I'm like an expert on kind of UK versus US. Some of the things that I've can pick up and offer is thinking about immigrant communities. I try to push forward the question of like, how did these folks get here in the first place? What were the conditions? So in the chapter of the origins of Islamic Relief, where I talk about, you know, I use A.R. Sivanandan, this intellectual kind of radical organizer in the UK of Sri Lankan descent, you know, his phrase for it is, we are here because you were there. And it's foregrounding, it's because of British colonialism in South Asia that South Asians come to the UK in the first place. So in terms of thinking about US versus UK Muslim communities, to understand the different kind of histories that bring Muslims into those places, obviously in the US, the transatlantic slave trade, the first Muslims in the US were here before the United States was the United States, which often also gets erased in terms of how we think about American Muslim communities as largely, yeah, it shifted after 1965 and the Immigration Act, that then we see more South Asians and Arabs coming in. There's another scholar, Ian Patel, that I use that talks about immigration was a code word for race because the former subjects of British Empire under previous kind of legal jurisdiction could come and work anywhere in the Commonwealth. After World War II, when more and more British Commonwealth subjects were coming from Black and Brown countries, that's when this kind of panic starts and all of this immigration policy comes through to try and restrict specifically Black and Brown subjects. And so then they move from being kind of subjects of empire into immigrants. That different history kind of matters for what makes up those different communities. And so in the UK, in general, the Muslim community is largely South Asian, or like, I think probably the largest percentage. And also compared to the US is more of a economically disadvantaged community than in general US Muslim. And so that also, that when you talk about the narrative around these kind of UK gangs, is also taking into consideration the class subjugation, that British Muslims are more likely to be less educated and, you know, undereducated in terms of the communities they're living in are underfunded, more structurally disadvantaged. So that context, I think, matters for the Islamophobic tropes that come in relation. In terms of Muslim advocacy, it is really highlighting that class position and that British Muslims have also protested on that basis as well, of that kind of economic structural disadvantage, which is distinct from kind of how Muslims have been racialized, I think, in the US.
It's so interesting you bring up class. We hardly talk about class or socioeconomic status, blue collar versus white collar professionals coming to the US. I remember when my dad came to the US in the 70s. He was this young engineer from Pakistan. He had studied in Canada and then he moved to the US to work as an engineer. And he has such fond memories of the United States because he remembers his time as this young engineer navigating a new space. And he was pretty familiar with it because his undergraduate studies were in Canada. And then I see so many problematic elements and things that have happened to immigrants who came to the UK as blue-collar immigrants, right? And that dichotomy, that class differential is often sidelined, but that's such an important component of how immigrants interact with countries that they occupy and their experiences moving forward.
Absolutely. Just to add to that, that I think that that's also where I understand class and race, and, you know, less underanalyzed in this book, but gender as well, is inseparable, right? So that a higher class position gives you a little bit closer ability to align with whiteness, whereas, right, like more blue collar, it's harder to kind of align and professionalize. So yeah, thinking these things as always interrelated.
I want to talk about the broader humanitarian work, the aesthetics of it, right? Is there a way in which the very aesthetics of humanitarianism, you know, the photos, the fundraising campaigns, the narratives, are themselves a form of racialization, right? Like, before the dollar is even spent, it's already decided who's the victim. And going back to our savior conversation, who looks like a savior? Do you think Islamic Relief is complicit in that visual economy?
Yes. You know, I was just reading my former advisor at the New School, who's now at CUNY, has a book Against Innocence, and she writes about this as well. She's written a lot about humanitarianism, Miriam Tichton. The aesthetics of humanitarianism is that pivotal part. We can't separate the ethics. It is a visual medium. And the right ethical kind of response is inseparable from the visual realm, the aesthetics of it. So I don't think that's part of, again, and it's not to, you know, blame individual Islamic Relief, you know, staff members, but it's the level at which they're operating as an institutionalized organization of humanitarianism, the aesthetics of humanitarianism, which is necessarily hierarchical. What Tichton writes about is like the regimes of innocence. The innocent requires its other, requires the one that does need to be caged or does need to be not saved or doesn't deserve. So it creates this binary that ultimately kind of traps us in these, you know, she's thinking through, and what I try to do in the book as well is, how can we kind of imagine doing good that doesn't need the victim and the savior?
But can we do that in the Western context? Because the entire Western foreign policy predicates on the idea of saving Muslims, saving the global South. So how do you break away from it?
You know, I don't think it's possible within the institutions that exist, you know, in the West or otherwise. It's a quote by Michelle Rouf-Triot that talks about that you know, these regimes, these Western regimes of even liberation were so prevalent that even kind of Global South's imagining take on that language, right? Like liberatory movements kind of take on the, so that's part of, you know, looking at Islamic Relief is, you know, where as long as we kind of remain within the institutions and models, it does recreate the savior. And so the savior themselves might not be racialized as white, and there's implications of that, but that logic is still kind of a logic of whiteness. So how getting out of that, you know, again, I try to close the book on these models of doing good otherwise, like bringing up these kind of abolitionist efforts, the student encampment movement of 2024, where students are imagining spaces. What would a university look like if it's not dictated by the capitalist model, neoliberal models, that education is a right, it should be free, that there were teach-ins, there was food at no cost, there was medical care, there was mental health care, there was, you know, all forms of accessibility were taken to, they were prefigurative, they were kind of bringing into practice an imagination of what kind of world we'd like to bring into being. And so I think that's, you know, for myself, of like, how do we get out of that is to realize like we're not going to find it in the modes that we have. It's these folks who are really imagining otherwise, imagining connection. Mutual aid is something I, you know, close and think about, that mutual aid is similarly, it's a recognition that that you know, we all together are facing this challenge. And mutual aid also, you know, at least how Dean Spade writes about it, is it's about why don't people have what they need. And so at the same time, it's also addressing what do we need to shift so that everybody does have what they need to actually flourish.
Did writing this book change how you personally give? Not as a scholar, but as a human.
Yeah, I think it couldn't not. Like the process of learning and being a person, absolutely. I do think differently. Like I gave my zakat to BBO this year, to Blue Leavers Bailout. But it shifted for me in terms of, you know, mutual aid. Also, I understand it as having an ethic of if someone tells me they're in need, I'm going to give. They don't have to prove their worthiness, that I take it on trust, that people shouldn't have to jump through hoops or prove I'm innocent or I'm good, but that mutual aid does have more. And so I'm more, you know, I think I give more like when I can on the street, on the subway, without, you know, having to kind of do this internal kind of ethical audit of, is this the right person? But to say like, if I have more than I need at the moment, what can I give?
You don't think through it as much. You do it because you feel you need to do it.
Yeah, I think so. Like I think, you know, part of my study has also shown me I have more than I need, like through, you know, with an analysis of capitalism, I have more than my fair share. I mean, you know, I'm not necessarily entitled to have more. So it's like, one thing I could add is like this, the ethic of zakat that Islamic Relief talks about, I think it's hard to do in the model that it's doing, given what, you know, we were saying about the institutions. But, you know, I do think that the ethical framing of zakat is a right of the poor. It's not that I'm giving, it's not my wealth. You know, Dr. Hani Albana, the founder of Islamic Relief, you know, he says like, this is their wealth. It's not ours. And so I think there's problems. It's hard to actually do that working within the institution, but that is that ethic, I believe, is it shifts it that I'm not helping, but I'm giving back what is already theirs.
Oh my gosh, Riya, that reframing is so good. I had never thought of it that way. And I've given zakat throughout, as Muslims, I mean, most of us do, right? And just to pivot it to that's their right. We are not giving them as a favor. Just changes the dynamic between the giver and the receiver. Wow. I just want to sit with this for a moment because this is so good. If someone listening to this conversation, a Muslim volunteer who works at Islamic Relief or any Islamic charity and is maybe uncomfortable, like you were, with some practices, what do you want them to take away from your book? Give us hope.
One of my students had said, you know, we get into the root of the problem. We're talking about the war in Iran. We're talking about, you know, American imperialism. And a student said, I love this class. We always go on a high note. And I'm like, I hope it's not all doom and gloom, but that when we understand kind of the root of the problems, we can imagine otherwise. And so, you know, yeah, for someone listening, that I'm also the white adjacent Muslim that wanted to do development and do good. Like that's me too. That's what I learned. And you know, I would hope folks can take away, you know, the importance of study, that this is something, you know, we end up talking about in my class. Is my students are really talking so much about like social media and what we consume and how what we learn is so curated that, you know, a lot of my students, and I'm going to be in conversation with Charisse Burden-Stelly in Detroit, and she had recently posted something about like the importance of study, the importance of reading, that we're on our phone so much that, you know, people have fought for freedom before. We can learn from our elders. Like there's an elder who talks about history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. The things that have come up in our conversation, Sadia, of like what people talk about or not, what we learn is political. And so we have a choice that we can choose to learn different history, to turn to different histories and to turn to different scholars, which is what I had to do. Like in order to come up with the analysis I do in the book, I had to read people who weren't part of my traditional academic training.
I think that's such a good point. Reading books from all over the world, and especially people whose lived experiences they are. Unfortunately, in the West, I see a lot of kids read Western-aligned books. And not just that, we see that with AI. You go on Claude or Chat, and if you type something, or if you're doing research, or if you ask a question, it's pretty much in line with what you would see in Western books, right? So it's so important to be aware and in some ways to be skeptical and being critical of what you're reading, right? That critical analysis is something that we are missing in those 30 seconds to 60 seconds, you know, reels or videos, because we just consume them without really giving them a thought of who's saying what and why. Rhea, in the end, if you were to define the United States of America in the context of giving, how would you do that?
Wow. I believe it's a nation state built on genocide and enslavement, and that the rhetoric of freedom has always been at the cost of others' unfreedom. The turn in the book of doing good otherwise is, you know, it's the nation state is irredeemable. The foundations have always required another. One's freedom has always required the other's unfreedom. So I think I'm turning to and kind of imagining forms of connectivity and solidarity that are outside of or, you know, not necessarily within the confines of the United States, of the nation state.
Thank you so much, Rhea. Where can people find the book?
It's on most of the book platforms, but it's published by University of Minnesota Press, so you can definitely find it on their website. And I always encourage folks to look for and support your independent bookstores.
And where can people follow you on social media?
Oh, I don't have a strong platform, actually. My Instagram is still private, but you can find me at @Rhea_Bonita, which is my first and middle name, but you can find me there. Yeah.
This was so good. Thank you for coming on Immigrantly.
Thank you so much. I loved your questions and I loved chatting with you, and thank you.
You know, I'm still thinking about the reframing of the dynamic between the giver and the receiver. When Rhea said it, it gave me goosebumps. It's just the mentality, right? How you see the other person, their humanity, their dignity. That changes the equation completely. There's no accountability. There is no privilege. What you're left with is humility through and through. This episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shi Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week and I have another important conversation. Take care and be kind to others.